Hi, and welcome to another edition of Kitchen Sink. It's Sunday, the 6th of September, and yes, the weather outside again. It's beautiful, but you can begin to feel that chill in the air. I say that because despite the beautiful weather today, I only wish we had it yesterday when we were up in London for our annual staff picnic hosted by the London Clinic, which was a fabulous affair. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about our day out yesterday in a little while. And just as I speak, I know that there is a few excited households in Ireland who will be watching closely the All-Ireland Hurling Final. I think certainly Galway will be roaring at the television as I record this. So let's see what the outcome is there. And equally, I know that the Italian Grand Prix is on at the moment. So I took the opportunity just to gather some thoughts, open up a few links here that have piqued my interest over the week, and maybe share some of these thoughts and opinions with you about some stories that have been hitting the news. I suppose before I begin, I just want to highlight once again that last week I focused a lot on the food tech A-level that's being abolished. And finally, there is a petition that is out there, and at least the first 500 signatures have been recorded on that. So I just wanted to share with you that this is really, really important. I'm sharing the link again on the show notes of this. And if you could just take 1 minute of your day, click on the link, and all you have to do, enter your name and your email address to say that you disagree with this decision by the government. And you just verify that once an email comes through and it's recorded. And obviously, if we can get 10,000, then the government will respond. But at least if they get a few hundred signatures, it just highlights that this is something that it is important, even if it's just to a small group of people. I know that the industry is crying out for people to join and to go into it. And I know that the NHS is crying out for people to be educated about food and for big food, you know, for the big manufacturers to find ways of creating delicious, tasty treats that we all like, but maybe from a healthier perspective. And the only way to do that is to have very intelligent people who understand food at a molecular level to be able to come up with new innovations and be able to deliver those products which eventually won't end up putting us in a hospital. So again, like I said, please go to the show notes and click on the link and sign the petition to, help the food tech teachers to do their job and to teach this A-level on food tech. So that's where we are on that. In terms of other news that has been going on this week, needless to say, the saga, as I said, about the tipping scandal is finally looks like it's coming to a head. Pizza Express have buckled under ongoing public pressure and announced that it will no longer deduct an 8% administration fee from staff tips paid on the credit card. That was in big hospitality. And it's obviously, you know, there's only so much that any company can put up under that pressure, and then they've got to make a decision. And I think that was a very prudent one by Pizza Express. I think the only thing that really that sticks in my throat on the whole story is Richard Hodgson, CEO of Pizza Express, says, "We have always been and will continue to be transparent about our tipping policies. We also agree with calls for greater clarity across the industry in order to ensure that staff are given a fair deal and to enable customers to make an informed choice when it comes to tipping." Well, to enable customers to make an informed choice when it comes to tipping, if Pizza Express were as transparent as Richard Hodgson says they were, do you believe that there would have been such an outcry? I think the outcry was the fact that customers didn't know that part of their tips was being deducted for company administration fees, and as a result, there was this major outcry. And of course, it turned out that other companies such as Coat were taking the cash tips as well, and even companies like Las Iguanas were actually effectively charging staff to work a shift. So I think it's slightly disingenuous to say that we have been transparent about our tipping policies when clearly they were caught with their proverbial pants down and had to come out with some very defensive statements and to backtrack and now to abolish it. So I think now they are very much more transparent than previously. And I think that you know, it just goes to show you that, you know, people power does work once the public understands what's going on. And of course, it was very quickly followed by news that Zizi and Ask Italian, who were both brands under the Azzurri Group, had also made that change to their policies and were not going to be taking any administration fee from their staff. So there you go, people power at its best. To be fair, I did say about 3, 4, 5 weeks ago that one of the things that we like to do is remove the discretionary or optional service charge, have it just removed, and then to pay the tip in cash. And it turns out that a little survey has been done, and 4 in 5 customers prefer to leave restaurant tips in cash. So research by CGA Peach, carried out with Zonal Retail Data Systems, reveals that 4 in 5 customers prefer to leave tips in cash to be sure that their serving staff receive them. So I think that's really interesting. You know, certainly it's something that we like to do just to make sure. And out of a survey of 5,000 British adults in April, it seems that cash is overwhelmingly preferred as the method of tipping, even when the main cost of the meal of food and drink has been paid by card. So there you go. So, you know, like I said, pay in cash and just ask your server, do they receive the tip? And hopefully the company they work for allows them to be as transparent as the chief executive of Pizza Express likes his staff to be, and they'll say thank you very much. We very, very much appreciate that gesture. Of course, this doesn't stop Business Secretary Sajid Javid ordering an investigation into the abuse of tipping in restaurants, which of course follows the reports about restaurant chains regularly holding back some or even all of the tips meant for the staff. So it goes on to say here that this investigation will consider whether there should be a cap on the proportion of tips businesses can withhold. So, I'm not so sure. You know, even the trade union in Ireland opposed, say it will be impossible to enforce. So he's Mr. Javid has ordered a formal call for evidence, which will end in November. The investigation will look at how tips left by customers are handled after recent reports, you know, as I said, found that certain restaurants were deducting and keeping that for administrative costs. Yeah, in my view, I think that's going to be a very Chilcot-esque affair where it'll be sat on for months and months on end. And eventually, I think it'll just be left to wither on the vine, because very often with these things, no matter what solution is put forward, there will be an argument made against it. And I think any government will find that it's very difficult to police. At least that's my point of view. In my experience, it's just best to let the staff keep the tips as they receive them. However, then there's the case made that some of the staff in behind the scenes, you know, in the kitchens, should get a share of that. The minute that happens, you then have to put some kind of system in place to regulate that. And the minute that happens, it can lead down the road of you know, who pays for administering that system. But let's see what the government makes of this, and watch this space is all I can say at this stage. So here's another story coming out of New York at the moment. And I have to say, this really did pique my interest when I read it, because, you know, here in the UK, we are talking about a shortage of chefs, a shortage of young people going into the industry, staying in the industry. So when I read about a 16-year-old, Flynn McGarry, opening his own restaurant in New York at the end of September, I have to say, in my book, I was quietly impressed with that statement. So, you know, obviously it's been done before. We've seen, is it Luke Thomas who opened his own eponymous restaurant at the age of 18? So, you know, somebody at 16 is going into business. However, what made the story kind of compelling was this idea that there is a famous chef, and I say famous, I haven't heard of him here in the UK, but possibly in America he's quite well known. David Santos used to run a restaurant called the Lauro in the same area that Magari will open, and he tweeted a rather strong response to the news, and in it, and I'm quoting here, so please forgive any language that I use, I am quoting. He says, "I'm sorry, but I hope that I'm not the only chef that it's offended by this. I shit this morning, more knowledge and life on the line than a 16-year-old has. The fact the media even calls him a chef offends me to no end. Chef is something you earn through years of being beaten and shit on and taught by some of the greats, not doing trails that your family pays for, because as a real chef, I don't treat people who trail the same way as people who sweat and bleed for me." So just to clarify, the phrase trail there is what we would call over here in Europe a stage. Stage comes from, I suppose, the French word stagiaire, which means to look. So very often people who are trying to gain further experience in the industry, they will spend time. It could be a couple of days, could be a couple of weeks, could be a couple of months in a well-known restaurant, or certainly where the chef is revered. They will basically work for free in order to see what's going on, experience what's going on, and get a taste of it. However, this gentleman makes the point that he would treat them much more lightly than, for example, somebody who he's employing. However, I have to say, I absolutely, totally disagree with pretty much everything that he has just said in that statement. Everything. You know, the whole idea that a chef is something you earn through years of being beaten and crapped on and taught by some of the greats, that is absolute codswallop. Pointless, a pointless statement. Those days are gone. That is an absolute, you know, any chef who thinks that that's the way to become a real chef, you know, what does that mean, a real chef? And this idea that you're offended by a 16-year-old who wants to open their own restaurant, and you're offended that they're being called a chef, I think that's, you know, that speaks to me that that person is a very, you know, they have a real chip on their shoulder. And I think they need to revisit those remarks and maybe just qualify them with a bit of common sense. You know, the young man in question, I've been looking a little bit further into this. He's opening a little restaurant called Eureka. It's a 3-day-a-week pop-up. Basically, a friend of his parents has a kind of restaurant premises that's closed over, I think it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And they've said to him, yeah, you can go ahead and open it. And he says that, let me just have a look here what it says. So here's what it says. "In terms of ownership, it's a thing that we're able to do 3 nights of the week, but we run everything. The person who owns the place, the way I know her, is she went to college with my mom, so she's a family friend. We have this space and you really want to do this, and so we're going to help you out." Which he then goes on to say the place has a full liquor license and insurance, so they can legally run a restaurant. He goes on to say that they don't want to put a label on it. "I'm calling it a chef's counter, but we're thinking right now we're going to stay 6 months. And then once we get to that point, I'll see if we want to continue or stop. I mean, we could end it in 2 weeks." So really, there's no risk, he goes on to say. There's a subsequent interview where he then, and this literally has just come out yesterday, or just was it earlier on today, just before I sort of went to record this, where there's a great interview with the young Flynn McGarry. And he goes on to say, so it says, "How many people will you employ?" "Zero." "Well, zero cooks or front of house staffers. We have 2 dishwashers. It's just going to be me cooking at the moment. But the tricky thing is, since we're only open 3 days, I'd have to pay someone like it's a 5-day-a-week job." So this idea that should he be called a chef? Well, you know, at the end of the day, he's the only guy who's going to be cooking. So at what point do you say that a person who's cooking for paying customers, and it looks like they're queuing up to because they're sold out until the end of October, at what point do you say that he's not a chef? Although, funny thing is, as I scroll down in this. Yeah, here's a question that was put to him. "Your most recent critic is David Santos, who said that you don't have the right to call yourself a chef. What do you think of that?" And this is his answer. And I have to say, this is where the guy gets kudos from me. He says, "I don't call myself a chef, but also, why couldn't I? It's a word." He goes on to say that another chef had a response where he just started naming random people and saying they're a chef, such as Monica Lewinsky. So he goes on to say, "But I get it. David has a point. Yes, people have worked really hard and have had really shitty lives. But why does that struggle have to be the norm? Why is it that having a terrible life, missing all of your family events, being treated like shit for 10 years, why is that the mark of being a chef? It just makes you bitter. I have nothing against him personally. Everyone always makes the same point, asking why people are calling me a chef. What else are you supposed to call me?" So I think that's a very, very valid retort to some very clumsy remarks by a guy who people are calling a chef. You know, what is a chef? This guy is terming himself a cook. And for me, I've heard the phrase that a cook cooks and a chef creates. And I think that the minute you run a business where you have to pay salaries, you have to make sure that you have paying customers. So therefore, you have to have some modicum of marketing ability. There's a huge amount that goes into running a business, which takes a certain level of creativity and tenacity and a thought process that goes far and above the ability to write a very clever menu or to put very clever textures or flavors together on a plate. And I know from my own experience of going from effectively a chef pâtissier working, you know, sometimes up to 16 hours a day, just thinking about the food that went onto the plates, nothing else. Maybe I had to think about a rota once a week for my two or three staff. I went to opening my own restaurant almost overnight, I would say, because that 12-week period between leaving full-time employment and going to open your own restaurant, where I had 35 staff, so I had 15, 18 chefs standing in my kitchen, and suddenly cooking just took up, wow, it took about 20% of my time, I would say, even though I've spent probably 10 hours a day in the kitchen itself. I would say that was 20% of my actual energy was spent around that. And in terms of desserts, which was the thing that took all of my time, that took up about 5% of my working week, shall we say, in comparison to my previous life. So, yeah, I would say that this young chef, Flynn McGarry, is a chef in my book. He is going to learn very hard and very fast what it's like to run your own kitchen. And let's face it, this guy who has been in the New York Times magazine, the spotlight is on him. The pressure is on him. So fair play to him. I wish him every success. And I do hope that, Neanderthal comments such as those by that other famous chef, I say with inverted commas, hopefully that that is a thing of the past and will one day be left in the past. What are your thoughts on all of this? Please do share them in the comments section below this podcast on thomaskilroy.com or perhaps over on Twitter where you can find me at My Kitchen Sink. That's S-Y-N-C as in synchronize. Or perhaps ping me a little email if you've connected with me or want to connect with me on LinkedIn. Then by all means do that. I know some people have reached out to me on LinkedIn and we have shared those remarks in previous podcasts, and we can keep your name anonymous. The main thing is to ensure that there is some sense of opinion coming from across the industry on topics such as this. Now, looking at a more positive story, I've got to tell you this really was fantastic. A former colleague of mine, Tim Sturck. Tim Sturck is head of coffee development and training at Baxter Story. And I have to tell you, Tim is one of the greats. Very, very passionate about coffee, passionate about people and development of people. And I have to say, I have a huge amount of respect for him. He has trained over 2,000 baristas there at the Barista Academy at Baxter Story. And he is responsible for putting not one but two young baristas into the finals of the UK Barista Championship, including number three in the country, Jana Slamova, this year. And he has written a fantastic essay, let's call it an essay, in Cafe Culture called What's in Your Cup? And what I like about it is This really strips away all of the BS that you often find that shrouds the topic of coffee. So if I just read just the opening few lines here, just to set the scene of what he talks about. If you lined up a series of supermarket or market stall fruits on a counter, for argument's sake, banana, apple, orange, pineapple, watermelon, strawberry and mango, and then asked your average customer, what is the flavor of this fruit? They would look at you like you had two heads, with each speaking a different language. They would all inevitably say the same thing, I hope. They're fruit. They all taste different. And they would be most emphatic about it as well, almost daring you to challenge that one. Of course, they would be correct. Fruit is the umbrella term for a category of food with dozens of flavours. But line up the equivalent in high street coffees, Starbucks, Costa, Caffè Nero, Illy, Lavazza, Benugo, McDonald's, in front of them and ask them the same question. What is the flavour of this coffee? I predict slightly varying responses like, which one are you talking about? Or, they're coffees, they'll taste like coffee. Or, are they cappuccinos or lattes? Or pointing at a familiar brand and saying, I don't like that one, so I don't drink it. But I do like that one over there, pointing at a different branded coffee. Coffee is the umbrella term for a category of food with thousands of flavors. Coffee is a fruit, by the way, that grows on trees. And he goes on to talk about the idea that generally consumers do not understand the differences between their coffee fruits, meaning that they think all coffees taste the same and that the only difference is the name on the cup. It's a really, really, really super good article. I recommend that you click on the link. I'm sharing this in my show notes. Click on the link and just take 2 minutes out of your day to read this fantastic essay. And he finishes it off to say, there is a small band of pioneers in the specialty coffee industry who are keen to share as much information as we can consume. As we have all things food and to a greater degree beverages, we need to inform ourselves of the differences that are available and decide for ourselves what we really like beyond the marketing and printing on the outside of the cup. So that's Tim Stirk, who is, a fantastic advocate for the coffee industry, making his point that do we really understand what's inside our cup of coffee? So anyway, I shared that article across LinkedIn, Facebook and Twitter. And I have to say, it has been, I've noticed that it's been liked and engaged with by some quite well-known people in the industry. But over on Facebook, a friend of mine, Stuart Middleton, and I've mentioned Stuart in previous podcasts, we were both commis pâtissiers back in the day at the Ritz, and he is currently working with Starbucks. He's a very, very highly respected member of the Starbucks team. So he gave a little reply in the comment section of LinkedIn, and I asked if I could share this. Now, I must qualify, this is Stuart's personal point of view. It doesn't reflect the company he works for. It's his own personal point of view, but I think he makes a very good point. He goes on to say, insightful as always, interesting perspective from Tim Stirk, and he says in brackets, huge respect. So he goes on to say, maybe the challenge here is that the small collective of artisan coffee suppliers are at risk of alienating consumers and missing the point of what they set out to do. Please and educate. Artisans are now so scientific and elite in their coffee collective that for the mainstream consumer, this just isn't accessible enough. Brands are delivering consistent, reliable, accessible, good quality experiences that customers can access. So the conundrum is, how do brands drive awareness to the masses to help educate around flavor? And how do the artisans find some accessible middle ground where Joe consumer doesn't feel intimidated to comply, appreciate and worship the latest hipster waxing lyrical about the alchemy and elitist dark arts of making coffee? And he goes on to say, Thomas, it would be good to see you in coming weeks and catch up for coffee. Branded or dark arts artisan, your choice. So, I mean, thank you, Stuart. That's a fantastic reply. And he makes the comment because obviously he represents a company that has built a huge global business out of making coffee very accessible to people who, yeah, sure, maybe won't be able to tell one from another. I think, however, I think one needs the other if coffee is to grow as a sector, in the same way as the wine sector grew, you know, 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. People just knew there was red, there was white, and then they started to begin to understand the differences between various whites and various reds. And now a lot of people are very, very fussy, to the point that even programs like Saturday Kitchen will wax lyrical, for want of a better term, about the wine choices around a dish that's being cooked, whether it's your heaven or hell dish. So again, a fabulous article by Tim Sturck on what's in your cup. Again, it'd be lovely to hear from you either on LinkedIn or on the comments section underneath the show notes, or even over on Twitter. Now, I've talked a little bit about social media over recent weeks, and I was very lucky and privileged to be part of a roundtable discussion hosted by the guys over at Hospitality and Catering News. And it's under the moniker hashtag H&C Social. And I have to say, I found it very, very insightful. It's great to get together with some like-minded people and talk about, you know, the future of social media. They've been doing some surveys, questioning, finding out what's going on, and putting together various training days to give people more of a better understanding of what you can do. Anyway, a question was put to them: why don't they host one up in the north of England somewhere? So I have to say, H&C News are going to host an event at Hotel Football in Manchester on October the 1st. So I'm going to share the link on the show notes. So anyone who's up around the Manchester area, if you'd like to be part of that, then it's very simple. Click on the link that I'm going to share on my show notes, and within it you will see that there is a link to a survey. And in the survey, they just want to gauge, you know, what's your use, what's your preferred sort of social media channels, and are there any particular questions that you would want asked at that event? Anyone who does that survey will get the results of the survey before they go to print, so that's pretty good. So I've filled mine out. But there are 20 seats available, and there might still be a few seats available. So why don't you click on the link, go in there and see, because I think it's a great experience. Great for networking, and you know, you never know what you might learn. So that's social media within hospitality. Here's a link that that I really want to share with you. Now, it is in the Daily Mail, so bear with me, because we know that many links that we've clicked on in the past from Daily Mail you have to take with a large pinch of salt. But this one is pretty good, because the people behind each of the contributions, I have to say, are some of the best known chefs in the UK. And what they've basically done is shared some of their food secrets that might change the way you cook. So these are some of some top chefs' secrets that they use in the kitchen. And there's some really good tips. For example, Atul Kocha, who's chef patron of Isindu by Atul Kocha and Benares, he says, when making guacamole, do not discard the stone from avocado. Instead, submerge the stone in guacamole. It prevents it from oxidizing and changing color. So that keeps your guacamole green. And let me see, is there anything else over here? Yeah, my very good friend and former colleague, Hayden Groves, he talks about making the most of cling film. And there's a couple of really good tips around cling film, because I think you'd be surprised what you can do with cling film. For example, he mentions about blind baking it. And you'd be surprised. It doesn't, as long as you get good quality, it has to be good quality cling film. Don't get that cheap stuff. You've got to get the really good quality stuff. But what I've found is, if you fold it or triple fold it, and you can line the inside of the tart or whatever it is you're baking, and then fill it with the baking beans, and then you, when you bake it in the oven and let it cool down, you can gently lift out, and it really fills all the gaps more than say baking paper. One other use I had for it in the kitchen just a few minutes ago, because today being Sunday, I was cooking some roast potatoes, and because I like to just parboil my potatoes before I shake them up to give them that rough edge around the outside before I bake them in the oven. So what I did again was just folded some cling film over, so I got double layering, and then I put it over the top of the saucepan, and I cut a hole in the middle, and as it came up to the boil, nothing went over the sides. No water dripped over the sides and down the side, and so there's a little bit less cleaning of the stove afterwards. And like I said, as long as you have very good quality cling film, it's a really, really good utility, shall we say, in the kitchen that many chefs use for lots of different things. So a really nice article in the Daily Mail, lots and lots of tips from top chefs. What I recommend you do, print it out, fold it up and keep it in that drawer in the kitchen. And I guarantee every time you want to do something in the kitchen, just pull it out and have a quick flick through and you'll see that there's some nice tips in there. Now, in terms of other resources, there's another fantastic little resource that I'm going to share with you. And this is in Time Out magazine. It's the top 10 street food stalls in London. And I have to say, this is the kind of bucket list that I could really have a go at. 10 of the most sumptuous, delicious, you know, food porn-esque eateries, shall we say, that London has to offer. Everything from smokestack right through to kimchinery. So I'm going to share that in the link. That's a really, really nice article. And thank you to Time Out for, you know, it's a tough gig, but somebody's got to do it. And they did. They went out and they found the best ones and shared them in a top 10 list of street food stalls in London. In terms of where have we been? Well, as I said, we were up in London yesterday, and we had a staff picnic. I guess would be one way of putting it. It was in one of those communal gardens near Regent's Park, and we went in. So it was a very nice, beautifully enclosed space. There was everything there, from bouncy castle for the children, and there was ice creams, and there was lots and lots of. Fabulous food, I have to say. Really nice barbecue, and then they had a big stall full of Eton mess that was worthy of something out of the Great British Bake Off. So we had a fabulous time meeting all my colleagues, and for example, one of our assistant housekeepers, John East, she has been with the housekeeping team 37 years. She retires at the end of this month, so it was wonderful to see her enjoying a time with her little grandson, and he's about 6 months old or thereabouts. So she's going to spend some more time with him now when she retires at the end of this month. So it was fantastic just to see and meet some of the families alongside my colleagues that I work with every day. So after that party ended around 5 o'clock. We took a wander up to Oxford Street for a little bit of shopping with Mrs. Kilroy and our 14-year-old daughter, who has to pop into Topshop and others to see what the latest fashions are. And then we decided we'll take a wander up to Soho, where we went to the House of Ho. And I've been meaning to go in there for many months now, and we said we'll have a go at it and we'll see. And I have to say, we were not disappointed. It's a fabulous little restaurant. It's one of those restaurants that you're never quite sure when you walk in, but I have to say, it's a very welcoming and cozy atmosphere. And very, very well appointed, you know, nice solid tables and a really nice, sensible decor, you know, and not done cheaply, shall we say, and not over the top either. I mean, it was good. And then in terms of the food, I mean, lots and lots of sharing dishes. And one of the dishes that was very much a standout dish was the shaking beef, it's called. And we had, there's two different size portions, but the one we had was 220 grams. And it's basically this gorgeous, I don't know, I'm guessing it's like sirloin or something. It's just the most juiciest pieces of meat I've ever tasted. And it just comes out literally just that, straight out of the off the char grill or whatever it is. And it's just cut up and you eat it with the chopsticks. Absolutely delicious. Pork belly, sea bream, just amazing dishes. Very nicely appointed. One thing I have to say, though, and this was something that I was always mindful of in my own restaurants, was that when we finished our meal, And the waiters came over and they were very efficient at clearing our table. But what they weren't efficient at doing was coming back with a dessert menu. And we were sitting there and we were kind of looking at each other to say, well, what should we do? Shall we have dessert or not have dessert? And I'm always a bit greedy about dessert. So I kind of said, well, let's see. Anyway, a few more minutes passed and there was no sign of any waiter to come and offer us a dessert menu. So we said, well, why don't we take a walk up the street? So we did. We went for a little walk up the street. And, you know, the thing about that opportunity was that they didn't offer us the dessert menu. We said, can we have the bill? We paid the bill, which was about £150 for four of us. So that was okay. We then took a little wander up the street to a restaurant called Yao Acha, which is owned by a restaurateur by the name of Alan Yao. And I have to say, they have this beautiful selection of patisserie, these gorgeous desserts that all absolutely look delicious. So we just asked, could we have dessert and coffee in the bar? And they said, sure, absolutely. So we went through to the bar. And I have to say, this is a very hip restaurant. I mean, very nicely, tastefully done. And they got these fabulous kind of rounded stools in the bar, but with a very high back where the back of it comes right up above your head. So you can actually lean your head back and to the left or to the right as if you're when you're talking to your partner. And what that kind of does is you can pull two of them together on the corner of the counter, and you have complete privacy with yourself and your dining partner or drinking partner, if you like, while two other people can be at the other end of that same table and not feel that they're encroaching in your space. It's very, very clever use of limited space. So anyway, we had some of the desserts. For example, passion fruit mango dome, which again was filled with white chocolate and coconut and so on. And for example, I had a dessert which was a pomegranate and yogurt mousse. It was a very, very nice dessert. And then one that my daughter had and my brother, malted milk it's called, which was a milk chocolate, almost like a truffle torte type mixture, and it came with caramelized honey and malt and an Anzac biscuit. So, I mean, these were priced at £8.80 each, and then we had some coffees and some really good jasmine tea. So we spent a further £50 in Yao Acha as a result of not being offered a dessert menu around the corner in House of Ho. But they're both restaurants that I would highly, highly recommend. I mean, I really do highly rate them. As I said, House of Ho in Soho, and around the corner, Yao Acha. Very, very, very trendy restaurant, which I can't wait to go back to and try some of their main courses. So that's pretty much it for this week. I suppose I could have a little management tip for you. And the management tip I'm going to give you this week is a very, very simple one, straightforward. Have you ever heard of Dropbox? And some of you will have heard of it. And if you have, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm sure that if you use it, you're a convert. If you've never used it or never heard of it, then let me just briefly explain. Dropbox is a kind of utility where you effectively can store documents, what they term as in the cloud, which means it's in a server somewhere for safekeeping, and it syncs with a file that's on your own computer. So, and the nice thing about it is you can log into it from any computer and you can access those documents. So, for example, if you have a Mac, you can download the app, put it onto your computer, and effectively it creates a window, you know, almost like a folder on your computer, like any other folder. But when you drag a file in there, it then saves a copy to this server, and then from another computer you can open up and you can access that document. Now, why would you use this? Well, there's many different ways you can use it. For me, I think it's really important that I have a number of folders where I have access to documents that I want to use. For example, this podcast. So once I've shared or saved this audio file and maybe some images and various bits that I want to put together, They all get saved into a folder within Dropbox, and then I can close down this main desktop computer, and then tomorrow on my commute into work, for example, I can open up my laptop and access the same files without feeling that I have to sit at the same computer. A really good use for it, for example, is why not scan your, if you're traveling, then scan your travel documents, scan your passport, save it in a document, and then if anything, the worst thing in the world happened and you happened to get robbed or your room got broken into and your passport got stolen, you can just go to down to the lobby of your hotel and you log into your Dropbox, and you will be able to print a copy of your passport, which you can then take to your local embassy. That's one extreme use. There's lots and lots of different uses. Fabulous way of working with your colleagues. So if you're working on a project, you can open up a shared folder among your colleagues. You can drop lots of things in there, and they can all access it. And it's a great way of being able to share documents across a team. So go to dropbox.com. Let me say that again. Go to dropbox.com and have a read. I think there's a little bit of a video on there as well. You can just have a look. A really, really good utility for anyone that works on different devices at different times of the day in different places. So there it is, your management tip of the day. Dropbox, give it a try. You'll be surprised. It's quite good, I have to say. I'd recommend it to anyone. So that's pretty much it for Kitchen Sink for this week. If you have any thoughts on what we've discussed this week, then please, why not share them in the comments section at thomaskilroy.com. Or perhaps join in the conversation over on Twitter. You can find me at My Kitchen Sink. That's sink as in synchronize. Or why not ping me a little email if you like on LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share some of your thoughts and opinions next week, especially if you wanted to keep your own name anonymous, because I appreciate, you know, when you're working for some big companies, you don't want any of your personal opinions to be confused with that of your company you work for. But in the meantime, this has been Kitchen Sink. I'm Thomas Kilroy. And until the next time, whatever you do, make it productive and fulfilling. Thank you for listening.